Welcome. Thanks for being here on this nice Sunday. I'm going to give you a presentation about what we did at ArangoDB for Kubernetes. So first of all, let me ask you a question. Who here is familiar with Kubernetes? Who's actually running Kubernetes already in something related to production? You should. Okay. Who's familiar with ArangoDB? Okay, well, some I know should be. And who actually is already running ArangoDB in production? On Kubernetes or something else? Great. Okay, so then I assume that at least some things are familiar. So here's what I'm going to talk to you about. First, I'm going to give you a short introduction into ArangoDB. Otherwise, marketing is probably going to shoot me, but I'll keep it short. Then I'm going to give a short introduction into Kubernetes, try to keep it as short as possible. And then I'm going to focus on what options you have for running ArangoDB on Kubernetes. And first I'm going to focus on what options you had until, let's say, 6 months ago, and why all of these options are actually really crappy, and why we did what we did in creating a special thing for it. Then I'm going to introduce that special thing and talk about what it is and how you can use it and why we think it is better than what we had before. Finally, I'm going to dive deep into that. So that is really for the developers who are interested in what happens beneath the surface and why these things are actually fairly complicated. And hopefully, if time permits and the Wi-Fi gods are with us, then we can do a little demo. All of the information is available on our website already. Everything is available for download, so you can just use it. And obviously, if there are questions, just I noted here questions in the end, but if there are questions in between, just ask. Good. Let's start with a small introduction into ArangoDB. ArangoDB is a multi-model database. Multi-model means that you can have documents, you can have graphs, you can have key values, and you can have all of that in the same engine and the same query language. And that's really helpful. Well, the statistics, basically it means we are growing like crazy, but we're still one of the new kids on the block, but we are already at very, very high customers. So, if you're looking at a single model, so before you had something like ArangoDB, you either had a relational database, or you had your document database, or you had graphs. And if your application needs, let's say, three of them, like you need documents, you need graphs, you need a key value store, you need to have three different databases, all with their separate maintenance, their separate upgrade paths, all that stuff. So that is a lot of learning, that is a lot of cost involved in maintaining that. And by combining all of that in a single engine, you still have to learn how to use a graph compared to a document, because even though they are in the same query language, a graph is by nature just a little bit different, but at least you can talk to it in the same way, you can maintain it in the same way, and that is really helpful. And in the end, what you're doing is you're reducing complexity just by putting everything in one thing. This is our query language. For example, you can just have a query language and you can select and you can do all the stuff. It's not like SQL, but it's in the sense that it's not exactly SQL, but it is very close and you can do some things that are a lot more powerful than what you can do with SQL. Again, that query language covers all the models that we have. Good. That was everything that I wanted to introduce about Kubernetes. About ArangoDB. Now let's dive into Kubernetes with first a introduction into Kubernetes. And the big question, obviously, is what is Kubernetes? And if you look it up, you can look at things like, okay, this is actually a kind of operating system for data centers or however you would like to call it. The Kubernetes organization itself describes it a little bit different, and they are talking about a system to automate deployment and in the end running containers. And that's really all that it does. But it does that in a very helpful way, in the sense that you don't care that much about scaling. You don't care that much about migrating stuff, about making sure that things are kept running, because that is, in the end, what the thing is being meant to do. And personally, I always think of it as just an operating system for clusters, for large clusters of machines, where like 20 years ago, the operating system that we all know nowadays made it easy to run multiple processes on a single machine. It's now made easy, more or less easy at least, to run multiple containers on multiple machines. And multiple machines can be as small as 2 or 3, but you can also go to 10,000 if you want, or even bigger. And as any operating system, it manages resources for you. And resources actually is a separate thing in Kubernetes, because there is everything is described as a resource. Something about the community around Kubernetes. Probably most people know that Kubernetes actually started at Google, where they had this big internal fight about whether they should make their knowledge of running containers at scale, whether they should make that public or not. And in the end, the guys who advocated to make it public won, because we now have Kubernetes, and still a lot is maintained, or still a lot is contributed by Google. But nowadays, this entire ecosphere of people involved in Kubernetes is really big. All the major players are involved and contribute a lot. And the last thing that I have to note here is that Kubernetes is moving fast, and I mean crazy fast. I know that many people have already said that it is only already a day job just to keep up with all the changes in Kubernetes. And in all honesty, I think that's not even fair, because I don't think that you can do it in one day, because it is really ridiculously fast. So this slide is actually something for ArangoDB internally, and that is why do we actually care about something like Kubernetes? Because, heck, we are building a database, and how people run them, it's nice. But in the end, it is really important that our database is being run in the right way. And lots of applications are being run now in Kubernetes. And we see that where we had Mesos, where we had some other stuff, Kubernetes, at least right now, is just the winning orchestration system. And obviously, you can still do the things in Docker Swarm and you name it. But lots of companies, also the small companies, everyone wants to be the next Google. So even if they have their application serving a couple of thousand requests a day, they still want to run it in a big scale and with all the features that Google has. So there is a very big cool factor involved. And while that is obviously not a reason for a business like ArangoDB to invest in an effort like this, it also helps, because developers are attracted to this platform. So people want to, and we are actually being asked by our customers, do you already have that? And how do we do that? And they just want us to tell them how to do it, which obviously is correct. But the good news, it actually helps. Besides all the cool factor and all the crap around it, it really helps you to run stuff in production in a way where you can actually sleep at night and not be woken up too often because things crash. Does that mean that things don't crash anymore? Hell no. They still crash. But Kubernetes will take care that at least most cases where something does crash, it just restarts it and you don't even see it. Perhaps if you later look on it in your metrics and you see a little spike or something like that, that's fine, but especially the self-healing mechanisms that are in there are just great, and they help a lot. So, a little bit about the concepts that Kubernetes is using. Primary concept of Kubernetes is you describe what you want, not how. You leave it to Kubernetes to actually do that. So you describe in what you call resource specifications, I want to have a container of this image running. I don't care where, I don't care how you do it, get it done. which is great because you just tell it what you want and you don't have to specify every individual step to say, well, that means that you have to download that image, you'll have to start somewhere on a machine, some process to actually run it. All that stuff you don't care about, you just say, I want to have this container running, and by the way, if the load goes above this, scale it up to whatever you want. That is huge. And that makes things in life a lot easier and also a lot shorter. And with everything that is distributed, and in the end, Kubernetes is about a very, very big distributed system. Distributed systems are hard. They are fun, but they're also hard. So if you can have a system like Kubernetes to make this for you and just say, okay, this is what I want you to do, now go do it, and then it actually does it, that's great. So you have these resource specifications, and you talk to a Kubernetes API server. That's one of the elements of Kubernetes where you say, okay, this is the resource, please store it, and now some controller in Kubernetes is actually going to do something about it. That split of, I have my resource, I put that resource in some storage, and then some other process is taking care that it's being done what you want. That is what makes Kubernetes work. And there are lots of different types of resources. This is just a very small list. So you have pods, you have service, deployment, node, secrets, but the list is much, much, much longer than that. And that's actually one of the things that keeps growing, especially also now that Kubernetes has made it a lot easier to add your own types of resources. And that's what we'll later on see is what we did. So just look at the basics. A pod, that's the smallest thing that you can deploy. So you can say, I want to have a container running, and then it will, in the end, launch a pod to do that. The downside of a pod is that a pod can die, and then nothing happens. So there are higher deployments, like a deployment, where you say, I want not only to run this container, but also to make sure that it keeps running. So if this pod dies, do something about it and just create a new one. You have services, and a service is a logical set where you actually talk to your containers. So you don't talk, at least in many cases, you don't talk directly to your container. You just say, this container, or all the instances of this container that I want to have running, provide a certain service, whether it is a website or a login service or whatever it is. And now this service, I see this service as a single point that I talk to over the network to access it. Which container actually handles your request, you don't know. And in most cases, you don't really care, except for some exceptions, which we obviously had when doing a database. You have nodes where the things run, and you have secrets. Those are the primary resource types. And again, there are so many more, but let's start with these ones. So that's all nice. And now what options do you actually have to run ArangoDB on that? And before I actually dive into that, I should tell you that you can run ArangoDB in roughly three different what we call deployments. You can have a single server, which is just like what it, the word says. It's one server. Everything is stored there. Everything is done there. Obviously not that scalable, but very good and very fast for small applications. You can also have a full, what we call cluster. And a full cluster is a thing where we make differences between types of servers. So we have servers that are equipped to store data. We have servers equipped to handle queries. And we also have some servers equipped to control all these servers together. And these have a role. And in a cluster, if we say we are starting a ArangoDB cluster, that means that we are starting at least 9 containers. So that is a big step from a single server, which is easy. You just install one container and then you go to 9 containers. The good thing of this cluster is that it doesn't only scale with taking bigger machines. It also scales horizontally. If you take multiple, if you need more storage, just add more servers that do storage. If you need more capacity to do queries, add more servers that does that. So now I'm going to show, well, I'm not really going to show, but I'm just going to give you the headlines of what it would take without any help. So just taking bare Kubernetes, Let's run MongoDB with just bare Kubernetes resources. Single server actually is not that difficult. I need a single container, as I already mentioned. I need to store my data somewhere, so therefore I need a volume, and I need a service in order to actually talk to it. Those are three resources that you have to provide. In Kubernetes, all these resources are described in YAML, and if you write that out, you can do that in roughly 60 lines of YAML. But obviously, it's already 60 lines of YAML, which to me is still a lot. And then I don't even talk about upgrading. I don't even talk about security like TLS or whatever. That's all adding to that. But we see that customers are actually doing this. And before, let's say a couple of months ago, they didn't have any choice because this was the only way you could do it. And obviously, the people that really know Kubernetes say, well, you shouldn't run this in a pod. It should be at least a deployment or a stateful set. Absolutely true. But this is just to show the basics. If you do that, which you should obviously, it just gets bigger. Now remember these 60 lines. Now we're going to make it fun because we're now going to run a cluster. And running a cluster, I already said you need at least 9 containers. So that ends up 9 pods, being 3 agents. Those are the ones controlling your cluster. 3 DB servers, that's actually storing the data. And 3 coordinators, that's where you send your request, and that's where all the queries are being done. And we just need 6 persistent volumes. That's good, we don't need 9. Why don't we need 9? Because these coordinators do not actually preserve state. So they write something, we don't care about that. We still need 1 service, and that service is actually pointing towards these 3 coordinators, because that's where you talk to. If you write that out in this way, you need 450 plus lines of YAML. So that is already quite painful, to be honest. If you try to print that out, it's taking a lot of A4s and it just makes no sense whatsoever. But still, sometimes this is just what you have to do because you don't have anything else. And we actually did it. It works. Obviously, we did it better with stateful sets and things like that, but it does work. But where are the problems? Because why did we do anything about it? Well, first of all, it is a lot of resource files that you have to write, and therefore the risk of getting things wrong are just growing and growing and growing. But in the end, it's fine. You can make it work, and if you are just careful, you can get it right. It's not a problem. And as I already mentioned, well, the pods can die, so let's replace them by nowadays stateful sets, which is great. It's already a lot better. And the question perhaps is, why do you need these stateful sets and not a typical deployment? And that is that internally in this cluster, we need some kind of stability, like the machines, all these containers need to know how to find them each other. So they need, for example, a fixed IP address. And that's something that you can provide with stateful sets. There are other ways of doing it, but this is the easiest way of doing it. But here's the big problem. As soon as you start upgrading the thing, because obviously MongoDB has bugs as well, and we add features, so we tend to release at least bug fix releases on a fairly frequent basis. And we actually encourage you to do upgrade because we know that we solve things in there. And upgrading is hard. Not just that you have to modify all this YAML in order to say, well, I'm now not going to use 3.3.13, but 3.3.14. That's the easy part. The hard part is that this is a complex beast. And we have, and I saw that you saw that in the previous slide, you have these different types of servers, and there are different rules on how you, there's a certain order in which you can upgrade. So you cannot just say, well, let's at random replace things, because at some point you're going to end up with a broken cluster. That's pretty much the same as saying, well, I'm bringing down my entire cluster, replace everything and bring it up again. Now it's upgraded. That's nice, but still your cluster is unavailable for some time and you don't want that. So in order to do that right, and that involves upgrading, but that also involves, for example, resilience if something dies, in order to get that right is really complex, because a MongoDB in a cluster approach is complex, like any database is complex. Having a persistent system on distributed system is just very complex and very hard to get right. And obviously, if you just think of the semantics that are there in a stateful set in Kubernetes, they are there for a general class of applications. And this is a very specific class of applications with specific rules. And that is really screwing things up. So again, just a sidestep to these stateful sets. Yes, they are good. If you don't have anything else and you want to have these stateful, please use them. But as I just mentioned, a database, not only a MongoDB, any database where you have this behavior, and especially if you want scaling and you want upgrading, you want all these things, they require some special kind of attention, and you really need to know the details. And actually, when we started writing the thing that will come next, we did find out that it is really helpful to write this very close to the people that know all the details there are to know about the cluster behavior, because you will end up needing that. And from the outside, that's just very hard to do. So what we needed is simplification. Again, a simple cluster, if you start stateful sets, is already more than 500 lines. I mentioned the upgrade process. I don't even want to think about doing that because it's just not fun anymore. So the first question that actually we asked and that we already saw people were using is, why don't we create a script that actually creates the YAML for us? Well, you can do that. It's not that hard. And initially it works great. You just create a script and you say, take this version. I want so many of this, so many of that. Go ahead, do it. And it creates a set of YAML files for you. You deploy them to Kubernetes and you're done. Fine. Until you enter scaling, upgrading, whatever. Then you are stuck with exactly the same problems as we had before when you did it manually. So again, we need still a simplification. Fortunately, we have in Kubernetes what is called custom resources. A custom resource is a very nice invention by Kubernetes, where they said, well, we cannot put everything that people on the earth may ever invent into the code base of Kubernetes, because it will explode. By the way, it is already exploding, so let's not make it even worse. So if you have your custom resource, like we have with a deployment of a database. Oh, did I switch something off? Does it work now? I don't. Can you still hear me?
Yes.
Good. I try not to touch that. Okay, so with a custom resource, you have two things. You have first, you have your specification of your resource. And obviously, this is custom as well, because Kubernetes doesn't know what you want. And the second thing that you have is something to actually take that resource and do something with it, make it actually happen. And you have to write both if you want to build a custom resource. And that's what we did with KubeArangoDB. And KubeArangoDB is the project name for, we say here, a operator. Right now, it's already three operators. I'll spare you the details for now. And a operator is just a more generalized term that is now being used for these things that actually control custom resources. So the primary resources in Kubernetes are controlled by what is called controllers. And an operator is just a nice name invented by CoreOS, I think, 2 years ago, that says, okay, you're specific to your custom resource, build an operator that actually does this thing for you. Now, how does this look like? I assume that most of you have already seen a resource for pods and what have you in a YAML file. And this is What a simple, again, keep in mind this 450 lines of YAML that we had before. And this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 lines. And here I describe an entire cluster. So we go down from 450 lines to just 6, which is kind of nice. Obviously, we can make it a lot bigger because I haven't told it which version to use. I haven't told it a lot of things that you can tell it. But if you just want a cluster, this is it. And this is what it does. So what do we have here? We have an API version. That is what you specify in your custom resource combined with a kind. So we have something called Rango deployment in the API version, which is basically a namespace database, rangodb.com/v1alpha. Obviously, at some point, we are going to change this to going away to alpha and it end up going to be just v1. But we'll keep backwards compatible soon. You need a name. That's just a name of this resource. And the resource here is a deployment of a RangoDB. And I need to specify what kind of deployment do I want. I mentioned before, we have three kinds of deployment, single and cluster we already talked about. And we have also something that is called active failover. And that is just something in the middle between single and a full cluster. But let's concentrate on the cluster here. This is how you would describe it. Now, I mentioned before that these YAML things are nice and you can write them. And even though they're long, the big problem comes when you want to do something with it, like scaling, like upgrading. So let's scale this thing. For now, I'm doing it on paper. And if we have time, we come to the demo. So scaling, let's say I want to have a lot of storage. Then I'm just saying, instead of the default 3 dB servers, I want 7. So I set the count here to 7. I do a kubectl apply, and kubectl is the standard tool to deploy stuff to Kubernetes. And I apply this file again. And now the system notices, hey, you wanted something else before you set 3. Now I want 7. So apparently, I have to do something. So what the kube-rangodb operator is going to do is going to make the difference between what it had and what you want now and say, OK, you want the count to go from 3 to 7. So we're going to add one, and we're going to add another one, et cetera, all the way until we reach 7. Scaling down, exactly the same principle. Obviously, we just remove machines after some careful consideration. Now let's upgrade. Let's say that RangoDB 3.3.14, that's the current version. Let's say that you started with RangoDB 3.3.13, like a month ago or so. And you now want to upgrade to this one. You just say, OK, let's take the new image with the new version. And there is actually a interesting aspect here that although I'm here explicitly putting a version number, in the end, this is just Docker image, which is found on the Docker Hub. And that tag, because the version is the tag part of the image name, that can be anything. So we don't really know what version it is. And we had to be smart about that as well. So upgrading, again, just set it, put in a different image. And as you can imagine, I mentioned before that this upgrading is complex because we have to do it in the right order and stuff like that. So the operator that we wrote now starts working on this and says, OK, you want 3.3.14. We now have 3.13. What are we going to do? So we are first going to replace an agent. If that comes up and everybody's happy, we're going to the next one, etc. So we're going to replace all the different containers in such a way that you don't have downtime. That's our primary goal. We don't want downtime. And obviously, if you bring one server down and replace it with another one, that can mean that your performance goes a bit down because you have less querying power and stuff like that. So maybe you even want to scale it up and then upgrade. But that obviously really depends on your load that you have in your system. So we did an upgrade by just putting in one line and creating one command. That's really nice. So let's talk a little bit about how you access the database. as I mentioned before, you have these services, and that's the way of Kubernetes to talk to a resource. And here we have the primarily, if you don't do anything, we provide you with cluster internal access. And that means that if you have your own application, whether it's a website or gaming site, whatever it is, running inside the same Kubernetes cluster, you can just talk to it over a dedicated DNS name. But sometimes you also want access from outside your cluster. For example, if you want to take your browser and talk to the database, because our database provides a web UI as well, if you want to do that, then that's outside the cluster. And you cannot use the DNS internal names of a Kubernetes cluster and just talk to it outside without some smart DNS logic. But Kubernetes has taken care of that, and that is by different types of services. That can be load balancer, that can be node port, and we actually provide both. And what the operator does is that it does not only create a service for you that you use inside the cluster, it also creates what we call an external access service. And that will automatically try to make a service of type load balancer. And if that fails, and there are reasons for it where it can fail, it will make a type node port service. And then you have outside access. Obviously, there are cases where you don't want this and you just set it to none and it's not set. So I mentioned load balancer can fail, and that is that the fact that your Kubernetes cluster can create a load balancer is a feature of your cluster, and not every cluster has that. So if you're running on the Google Kubernetes, it creates a Google load balancer for you. If you're doing it on AWS, you get an AWS load balancer, etc. But if you're doing it on your own bare metal setup, you don't have a load balancer by the, at least unless you create some additional stuff. So we try to create a load balancer. If that doesn't work, fine, we create a node port and you can still access it. Do keep in mind that when you talk to that, we do TLS by default. And that's the biggest mistake that we have seen our customers make. They say, well, I cannot connect to my cluster because they are curling to the DNS name and then the port name without HTTPS. Then it doesn't work. Storage. Let's talk a little bit about storage. As you can imagine, storage is probably the most important thing for a database. That seems pretty obvious. And ArangoDB, like any database, really loves locally attached SSD, as fast as you can get them. The faster, the better. We cannot be emphasized that hard enough. Now, here's the problem. Kubernetes, by default, in its at least in its the way that typical cloud providers like Google are offering it, provides you volumes that are network-mounted volumes, which is nice. And if you have don't have that many performance requirements for your I/O, it works perfectly fine, and there are lots of benefits of doing it, but it's really, really bad for a database. So we had to do something there. Because while we know that some providers do provide you with volumes that are actually mapped on locally attached SSD, a lot of them are not. So we provide a Arango local storage resource and also an operator to actually do something with that. That is a resource as well, which you can create, and it will create volumes for you on the nodes of your cluster. So assuming that you have SSD on the nodes of your cluster, if you have very slow spinning disks, don't even bother. But if you have fast SSDs on your nodes, this is the route to use. This is how it looks. Again, we have some API version and a kind that's, of course, slightly different. We have a name. And the most important is the local path on your nodes. So if you have mounted a fast SSD on all of your nodes, create and mount them on a certain path and put that in here. And then what this operator will do, it will create volumes underneath here. So there are some subfolders in here and it will just mount some volumes in there for you. Obviously, that means that now your container is suddenly fixed to that node, which is bad. or good, depending on how you look at it. It's good for performance because it's the fastest that you can get, but moving that around is really bad. And that's one of the reasons that underneath the ArangoDB operator is creating pods. And if the pod dies because your node is restarted, we know, okay, this is on the same, there is a volume on the same node. We can either stick there and just create a new one on the volume, or we have to start moving the data somewhere else or recover the data from somewhere else. And that is what we can do in a cluster. In a cluster, you have in all your collections or your database collections, you have a replication setting, and you can say, I just want my data to be stored in two places. So if one dies, no problem whatsoever. We just migrate it from the one that still had it, and everything is fine. So obviously, if you want to use this, don't use a replication factor of one, because you can be screwed. If that node dies, then you have a problem, and there's nothing that you can do about it. Let's give a short overview of what we already have in our operator. We support all our deployment modes. We have automatic TLS, so everything is HTTPS colon blah blah blah. We have automatic authentication in place. And you can have, and that's an optional one, you can have locally attached persistent storage. And finally, we have what we call DC to DC, that is data center to data center replication. That is another feature of the ArangoDB right now cluster deployment, where you can have a cluster in data center A and a cluster in data center B, and then say asynchronously replicate in one direction. Why do you want to do that? Either because of you don't trust that data center. If that one burns down completely, then you still have a copy over there. But the other reason why you want that is if you have a global application, then it can be very helpful to have your data available locally. So for example, let's say you have your application and you have a data center in North America and you have a data center in China. Now all your reads can be done locally. Your writes still have to go to one because the replication is only going in one direction. But for most applications, the reads are the majority of operations. So at least for your reads, you have your data locally. We support that now in Kubernetes as well. It's just another line in the specification. Say, oh, by the way, I want the thing replicated. And with a custom resource, you configure it that it actually starts talking from data center A to data center B, which is nice. And eventually, this will also completely support Kubernetes Federation. But right now, that's not the case. How do you install this thing? Let's have a quick look at the time. I will hurry up a bit. Obviously, the operator has to run somewhere as well. That's a piece of code which is in some containers, and it needs deployment as well. Right now, if you go to the release page, there's one option. If you wait for the next release, there will be two options to install this. The preferred one is Helm. Helm is the default package manager for Kubernetes, and it's really easy to work with and really easy to tweak. And the second one is kubectl apply, and then with a couple of resource files that we give you. That's all that you have to do. It takes a couple of minutes, not even a couple of minutes, typically 1 or 2 minutes, and it's done. And after that, you can start deploying your custom resources. Now, we said in the title of this presentation, we said this is for DevOps. So it's not only for developers, it's also for operations. So we did make sure that you can monitor this system as well as possible. So where can you look? Well, obviously, you have the logs of everything. That's easy. You have the status part of all the custom resources. We tell you when you deploy a Arango deployment, you can ask for its status and describe all kinds of events. So when we detect that a pod was dying and we replaced it with somebody else or another pod, we create an event for that. And all of that information is available there. And I think in the end, most important, we support Prometheus in a very big way, which is just measuring certain counters and stuff like that. And you can make them visible with Grafana on top of that. it sounds like, yeah, this is nice, but maybe I only need that when I'm doing heavy production and I want to tweak my load and stuff like that. We have learned so much by having Grafana during our debug sessions, you cannot imagine. Because then you suddenly see a spike there, which you cannot explain from what you're doing. And most likely that means that something there is happening that you either didn't expect, so your expectations are wrong, or you have a bug. And obviously, we also make a lot of bugs, so in most cases it was just a bug. But that was really helpful, and I think that if you are not already in production, make sure that you have monitoring on that, because it's really helpful. Finally, about what the thing actually does, we support a couple of providers, and a provider for Kubernetes can be Google, it can be AWS, it can be Azure, you name it. And here's the problem that we have. We say any Kubernetes 1.10 or higher cluster that you have, you can run on, no problem. But then there's a big but. And the big but is, in order to get there, you have to pass things like authentication, how to talk to your Kubernetes cluster. And those things, we have found out the hard way, are pretty different for example, Google on one side versus AWS on the other side. AWS also has a Kubernetes engine. If you compare that with the ease of use that you get with Google, it's pretty much night and day. We have spent a lot of time just figuring out the authentication of authentication of the cluster access on AWS. That is just hard. So what we see, and that's also what we talk to our customers about, is which cluster are you on? Are you on Google? Are you on your own bare metal? It doesn't really make a difference for Kuparango to be our operator in the end, but in for us to help you set it up in the right way and ask the right questions if you have problems, we need to know which provider it is, and we are therefore also testing heavily on the various providers. Right now, as of the next release, we'll mark production ready for Google Compute Engine. And the other platforms are still ongoing testing. Does that mean that it doesn't run there? Absolutely not, it runs fine. At least we don't know of any issues yet, but we haven't passed all our acceptance tests on there. And as I mentioned before, Federation is not yet available. So let's quickly take a deep dive into this thing. First of all, what does this thing look like? If you really want to know the details, go to our GitHub page, github.com/arangodb/kubearangodb, and you find everything there. We have multiple operators in a single package. So we have three different custom resources, one for deployment, one for setting up the replication between data centers, and one for local storage. And all of them have their own operators. And for various reasons, we have chosen to package all of those in a single image, but still have different deployments. That just made it a little bit easier. And for the various custom resource definitions, like the Arango deployment, you'll find there a Go, everything is written in Go, a Go structure that defines the specification, that defines the status, etc. And as anyone who has written a operator before will know, there is a lot of generated code. One side, that's helpful. On the other side, that makes it annoying to build because your compile times get bigger and stuff like that. But that is what it is. Of every operator, for example, take the operator that takes care of the Arango deployments, we deploy two instances. And actually, one is only working at the same time. The other one is doing a hot standby. We found that when a node goes down, even though this is a deployment, so Kubernetes will schedule another one if your container dies, we found that just having another one standing by is a lot faster, and we can quickly, much quicker, run and start solving problems if for similar reasons pods die. Good. Well, a lot of code is shared, and finally, we talk a lot about we are heavy users of Fineline, so I'll come back on that later. Let's have a little bit look inside here around the deployment operator. It creates some members, and a member is just an other way of saying this is a server of a certain type. So it can be, for the cluster case, it can be an agent, DB server, or coordinator. And for a member, we create a volume, we create a pod when it needed, etc. And that's actually the key part here. We have a single inspection and control loop per deployment. That means that the operator is constantly, well, more or less constantly, looking at, I have my specification here. This is the current state of the system. Is everything still fine? If so, fine. We sleep for a little bit of time and we try it again. If not, we act on that. And in order to make that actually work in a way that we didn't lose our mind on debugging it, we made it in several layers. And let's have a look at those layers. I put them here the highest, but it's actually the lowest layer is the resources. So that just makes sure that pods are there, volumes are there, etc. Then we have reconciliation. That is, hey, my specification says I need 7. Here I have 3. Now I need to do something. Could be creating members. And finally, we have resilience. And resilience is a layer that looks at the entire system over a longer period of time and figures out things like, hey, this server now crashed for 5 times within 2 minutes. What's wrong? Let's do something about it. So all these layers have a different kind of responsibility in the overall system, and that helped us a lot in just making this thing work. A note about finalizers. We put finalizers on any resource, and a finalizer in Kubernetes is just a label that says you cannot delete this resource until this thing is gone. Somebody has to actually remove that finalizer, and we use that as a kind of restriction for, you can think of it as a garbage collection. We can only remove a volume that has certain valuable data if we know that that valuable data is saved somewhere else. So we keep a finalizer on it, and we have these checks to make sure that everything can be done right. It's really helpful. It saves a lot of problems, but also makes debugging really hard. Because if you screw something up during debugging, you end up manually removing all these finalizers, and that's just not fun. But again, that's our problem. Let's have a look at let's see if we can make it work. I'll try to do this very quickly. Is this somewhat readable, or should I probably enlarge it? Right now, I have here a cluster on Google Kubernetes, and right now these are the 4 pods that I have running there. And as you can see, we have a deployment operator twice, and we have a deployment replication operator twice. So right now, I have not done anything in terms of deployment of databases. I just have operators deployed. And now I'm going to do a kubectl apply command. Should be in the right directory. Kubectl apply. What I'm now running is I'm applying a simple cluster YAML file. I can show you the YAML file. Let's do a cat. It is probably not really readable in the back, but it is more or less the exact same that I showed you on one of the earlier slides. In order to see what's going on, I have a watch of kubectl get pods that I'm running in the above. And what you can see is it, besides the 4 pods that we had initially, you can now see it has an example simple cluster ID. I make that a little bit bigger as well. Let's see if that works. Now the ID will be gone. And the ID pod, initially, earlier in the talk, I mentioned something about these Docker image tags containing a version or not. And that's actually a problem, because we need to know exactly which version it is if we want to have the right upgrade rules. So what we do for every deployment is we first launch a single container in the most simple and quick way that we can, just to ask it, give me your version. Then we kill it. So that is a very quick container, and then we know the version, and then we know, okay, this image, and then we have the right SHA hashes, etc. We know the image, and we can work with it. After that, it starts a couple of pods. So we have three agent pods, three coordinator pods, and three primary pods. The primary is just the old name for DB server. So that's where the actual data is. So they are running right now, and now I can do a kubectl get service. And then I see here all the services that I have in my cluster, where some we already had. But now, for example, simple cluster, that is a cluster IP type of service, meaning it's only available inside my cluster. But the good news is I also have an example simple cluster EA, external access, which is of type load balancer. And if I now go to, I have to take the right one, the external IP address, I can access the service. Now, in order to do that right, I mentioned before we have TLS, which means that every connection between every component in the system is secured with a TLS connection. And for that, you need certificates. We don't ask you to create all these certificates. We don't use Let's Encrypt. We create them ourselves. So they are self-signed certificates. Obviously, you can provide your own if you want, but just to make it easy, we create them for you. So if I now open this one in a browser, my browser is going to complain like crazy that this is not trusted. So in order to make that a little bit less annoying, I'm going to I must type it right, example, simple cluster. So what I've now done is I have some aliases for that. So I won't share you the details because it's really annoying. But I have asked Kubernetes, give me the CA certificate for those TLS certificates. And I have installed them locally in my system. So now when I open, let's take this URL. So now when I open a browser, it should complain less. It will, let's run that one. It will still complain, even though I installed it, but I installed it and then it used the internal DNS name. And here my browser says, you're trying to connect to that over this IP address, and that doesn't match what's in the certificate. So do you really want that? Yes, I really want that. Where is my mouse? Here it is. Can we, why don't I get, for whatever reason, it doesn't respond. Let's take in a one. Somehow I think my UI is now blocked. Let's see if we can redo that. And it complains. And it will complain again. And now I have reached the web UI of my cluster. And if I log in there, it is still complaining that I didn't have all the three cluster certificates right yet. That's the downside of Opera. It's a little bit slow in synchronizing with the certificates. You can see I have three coordinators, three DB servers. You don't see the agents in here, but my cluster is up and running. And I can now start creating collections if I want. This is now all running in a Google Kubernetes cluster somewhere in Europe. I don't even know exactly where. And that's basically it. We can start playing with this. and we can start upgrading it if we want. We can do all kinds of stuff with that. But I fear that my time is limited. So I suggest that we go to the questions quickly. So first, some closing words. You can deploy a RangoDB very quickly now on Kubernetes. You saw it. It took me, 2 minutes, and we have a cluster up and running. And I didn't have to write any long YAML, just a couple of lines. An interesting side effect that we had of creating this thing, that it turned out that Kubernetes is a really, first of all, a bug magnet for a RangoDB. You have no clue how many bugs we found in a RangoDB just by running it here and trying to get this resilience business completely automated. Because if you don't have that, then Kubernetes can be fairly unforgiving. And it was also a feature magnet. We didn't expect that. And one thing that I would like to give an example on here, for example, is load balancers. We have, as you can imagine, in a database, you do a query and then you get back a cursor. And with that cursor, you can fetch all the requests or all the remaining data that's in there. If that is a small set of data, no problem, you get it in a single request. If that is a large set, then you have to go multiple requests to the server in order to fetch it. And what we had before is that for every request, there was a little state on a coordinator in memory that says, well, for this cursor, I can still give you the rest of the data. So this suddenly means that you have to make sure that your request that you initially made to fetch the query or to initialize the query, and then the second request that you make to get more data has to land on the same coordinator. Now, in here, we have all kinds of load balancers. A service, even the most simple service, is already a load balancer. And it doesn't tell you which coordinator it lands on. So in order to make this happen, we added some functionality to the cursor support to actually understand where the request came from. And if your follow-up request doesn't land on the right coordinator, it will automatically pass it on to the one that actually has your data. So now you don't have to care about that anymore. But this was one of these features that we didn't think of when we started this whole project. But in the end, it made things better. And even now, if you don't run Kubernetes, if you put a load balancer in front of an RangoDB cluster, no problem whatsoever. You can just use it. Final closing words, distributed systems are just fun and complex. But let's start to keep it with fun. Some links, obviously you can just go to GitHub and go to the documentation, etc. And if you ask questions, please ask. Thank you very much. We are hiring. If you are interested in Kubernetes, please talk to the woman over there. And thank you for your attention. And if there are any questions, now is the time to ask them. Questions, anyone? Yeah.
You mentioned that there are three.
Can you pass it along?
So you mentioned that there are three modes of RangoDB. This single mode, basically the failover and the cluster.
Yes.
And I think you talked mostly about the cluster, yeah, which is totally understandable. But let's say if I run, could I run this in failover mode?
Right? Yes.
The operator would support me there as well.
Absolutely.
How would the upgrade path then look like?
It will do pretty much the same. It will first, in active failover mode, you need typically 5 containers because you still need agents, 3 agents. And then you have 2 servers and they do an active failover between the two. And it will first upgrade the agents one at a time. And it will then do the 2 remaining servers. It will upgrade them, and which means that one of them is the leader. And whichever one you take first, it doesn't really matter that much because the other one will notice right away. So the remaining one will notice, hey, I'm no longer, my leader is now gone. So I'm taking over. And the first one will be upgraded. The second one will be then brought down, which means the first one will recognize I have to become leader. So it's pretty much the same process. Other questions?
So you mentioned that the current way of installing it is like you give us some YAML files and we can do kubectl apply.
Yes.
But you also mentioned Helm, that it's, but it's not completed yet. Is there some kind of timeline when to expect this?
Next week. No, seriously. We currently have it in a pull request and we know it works. We just have to merge it and put it in a release.
All right. Okay.
So that's really coming really quick in the only topics that it's still hanging on is finalizing all the documentation fixes. But the, just to give you a comparison between the two, if you do a kubectl apply of the resource files that we provide you, then, for example, the operator is deployed always in the default namespace. With Helm, you can configure that, which is great. And you, with Helm, you can also say, I'm going to create the operator multiple times in multiple namespaces. That's true for all two of the operators, the deployment and the replication, because the local storage is always deployed to the kube system namespace. But there are lots of, I think you have a list of probably 15 settings that you can tweak in the Helm chart. Obviously, you could also tweak those things in the YAML resource file that we provide you, but that's just more work and it's much more complicated.
Last question, Kubernetes has this node affinity feature.
Yes.
Is there a way to tell the operator to include basically a definition or my understanding of, I want node affinity, for example, the components of the cluster setting, the cluster setup that need persistence. Is there a way to give this to the operator so it can?
Yes, you can do that on two levels. You can, first of all, in the if you use the Arango local storage resource, you can have a node selector in there so that you can limit it to certain nodes already. And the second thing is that you have is for the Arango deployment, you can have per group of servers, so that is agent, DB, whatever. You can say, well, I either use a node selector or you can use these tains that are now being used more to have some affinity as well as anti-affinity to certain nodes. With that, you can create deployments where you, for example, say, I run my agents on these three boxes that I really, really, really care about and all my database things are being deployed on nodes where I have big SSDs.
Thank you.
Other questions? Then I thank you for your attention. And if you have questions, please contact us. And if you're interested, please talk to us. There are lots of people here also with Arango shirts. And if you want, we have some Arango shirts here as well. So come by and take one. Thank you very much.